My name is Jeremy, so I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Jeremy.
Hi. Thanks for having me. Thank you, Billy, for asking me to come up. Couldn't ask for a better day for a drive from Richmond up here. I mean, it was absolutely beautiful. There's things like that that I never would have noticed before. I spoke here. I was close to a year, not quite a year. It was the first time I spoke here, I think. And, you know, my story is probably a little bit different since then, you know, because as I've gotten sober and had new experiences with the steps, especially when I take other people through it, I've gotten a better understanding of who I really am and what my past really was. You know, a huge part of my story and my life was just delusion, you know. The way I saw reality and the real world is just not a comfortable place for me. I was born and grew up in Smithfield, Virginia, down in southeastern Virginia, small little town. I'll just kind of briefly tell you, my childhood was pretty chaotic. You know, I grew up with a mother who was an alcoholic and a drug addict, and a stepfather who was physically abusive to her and to me. And, you know, my earliest memories are of being woken up in the middle of the night, piled into the car, we're leaving, we're never going back, and then going back and doing that over and over again. By the time I was 8 years old, my mother left and never saw her again. My twin brother and I were left with our stepfather, who, like I said, was physically abusive. By the time I was 13, the abuse had gotten bad enough that I was actually blinded in my left eye as a result of trauma. And then I entered into the foster care system, bounced around between a few different homes, the foster care system, before I wound up in a wonderful home. I'm sure that my childhood colored my defects in a certain way, but I can tell you that it's not the source of my alcoholism. It's just my circumstances. You know, I've, through the process of working the steps, when I did a thorough inventory the first time, and I've gotten some enlightenment about that since then, as a result of the fourth and the fifth step, what I can tell you is that for the longest time, up until I got sober, up until I had this psychic change that we get here, my childhood was much, much, much worse than it actually was. You know, my perception of things was that it was absolutely nightmarish. And I held on to that for the bulk of my life. You know, I played the victim card. This is why I am the way I am. This is why I drink the way I do. This is, you know, I've been dealt a bad hand. Constantly, I have the worst luck. And I've gotten a lot of clarity about that. When I look back, you know, there's no doubt it wasn't roses necessarily, but there were good moments in my childhood. And, you know, the best thing I've learned is that I can let that go. And I can, you know, I left that household, ended up in a wonderful foster care home by the time I was 14 years old. I mean, from that point on, it was on me. You know, I had no excuse to fall back on after that point, but I used that one to the end. As a result of that, you know, I grew up, I was very, involved in school. I was a good student. School was a safe place. I loved being there. I loved reading. It was a form of escape for me. I don't do well in the real world. Full of fear. As far back as I can remember, I was that anxious kid, you know, really shy, and, had a hard time getting along. So, you know, I excelled at school. That was somewhere where I could do well. But as a result of the childhood I'd grown up, my mother and my stepfather, I told myself I was never going to drink. I'm never going to smoke. I'm going to do everything within my power to set myself apart from the family that I grew up in. And the plan was to, you know, go to school, become a doctor, save the world. Lots of potential. And, you know, I managed to do that Through high school, there were probably plenty of opportunities that I could have drank. And I ended up starting my drinking career the summer in between my freshman and sophomore year at VCU in Richmond. What I can tell you is that by the time I took that drink, I was in desperate need of that drink. My memories are just full of anxiety and fear as far back as I can remember. I was constantly inside my head, trying to predict conversations. They're going to say this and then I'm going to say that. And it was just this, it took so much energy for me to get by, for me to connect with other people and just to pretend like I could fit in this real world. And I had no clue that I was in such desperate need of that drink. And, when I got drunk the first time, we walked around Richmond going to a few different house parties. That particular night, there was actually a meteor shower, and we wound up on this roof passing around a bottle of Jack Daniels watching this meteor shower. And it was the most magical experience ever. I had no clue that I needed that relief so much. It was just like, and I was hooked. I was in love immediately. My first thought was, man, I wish I'd known about this earlier. I would have started off way earlier if I'd known what an effect alcohol could have had for me. I am of the opinion that alcoholism requires alcohol, but I believe that I was born with a spiritual malady. Chuck C. talks about this being this disconnectedness from other people and from power greater than myself. And I know that looking back now that, that was my problem. The bedevilments, I could not connect with other people, relationships, I'm prey to misery and depression, fear, anxiety, and I could not get by in this world. And I'm so forever grateful that I discovered the drink. Because I believe that if I'd gone on the way I was living without alcohol, I probably would have killed myself. So I am of the school of thought today that I'm so forever grateful that I discovered alcohol and that I'm an alcoholic. It's funny when you sit down and you're trying to help somebody. When I sit down with my sponsees and stuff, how stuff just falls out of your mouth. And I'm like, where did that come from? I was sitting down with one of my sponsees the other day, and what came out of my mouth was, the question was, and I remember this question from early sobriety was, does it get better? And my answer was, a little flippant at first. It's like, do you think I would do everything I do if it didn't? This is, if I didn't get good results out of this deal, I wouldn't do everything I do. And what fell out of my mouth, and it's sort of stuck with me since then, was, if I knew I would get the same results I have today, I would go back and do it all over again. I would go through that hellish childhood. I would go through those magical fun years of drinking. I would go through the deepest and darkest hell that I've ever experienced in my life at the end of my drinking. I would go through that awful 6 months, year of early sobriety. I would do it all over again if I knew that this is where I would end up. So that first drink, was a turning point in my life. It was, I came alive. And, from that point on, unbeknownst to me, I was drinking alcoholically. That was the semester between my freshman and sophomore year of college. My freshman year, I was at VCU on a full scholarship. Had a 3 point something GPA, all A's and B's. And by my sophomore year, my first semester, I ended up withdrawing from all my classes because I couldn't go to class. I was drinking too much for that. And I didn't know that at the time. What I would have told you is that I have insomnia. I have trouble sleeping. I have anxiety. I just need to take a break. So I withdrew from all my classes. Gather up all my willpower, go back for the next semester, the spring semester. All right. Let's do this. That semester, I didn't even have the wherewithal to withdraw from my classes. I just failed them all. And then I decided I need to take a semester off. And then 13 years later, I made it back. So, you know, I had no clue that I was experiencing consequences from my drinking right off the bat because alcohol was working so well for me. You know, I dropped out of school. I started working full-time in restaurants. That is the place to be if you're a drinker, alcoholic like I am. From that point on, up until I started trying to get sober, my story's kind of boring. You know, I am just a drunk amongst drunks. I'm a textbook drinker. You know, I don't really have any crazy law stories, legal troubles, or anything super crazy. I mean, it's pretty run-of-the-mill stuff. You know, what my average daily day looked like from that point was roll out of bed, go to work. I worked a lot of doubles. I worked a lot because, you know, it takes a lot of money to drink the way I do. I was about to say and pay bills, but I didn't do that. So, so we're all out of bed, go to work, make a pocket full of money. We get out, we go to the bars till it's 2 a.m. We go back to somebody else's house, do some more drinking, make our way to Third Street Diner in downtown Richmond, 6 o'clock for first call. Have some more drinks, get a few hours worth of sleep, roll out of bed and do it all over again. I mean, and that's pretty much my life from the time I was 20 up until 26, 27. I mean, that was the norm. And I was a daily drinker. The first time I got sober, I look back, I really don't believe that there was a single day I didn't go without drinking. If there was, I mean, it wouldn't surprise me if there was one, but I can't remember it. And, you know, those first few years were magical. It was a lot of fun. I made a lot of friends, people who drank the way I did, and we went and did a lot of fun things. You know, we'd go camping, we'd go to the beach, we'd go out dancing, we'd go do karaoke. Thank God I was in blackouts for most of that. And did a lot of fun things. You know, as the years went by, with my drinking like that, that stuff started to fall away, you know, and it was me sitting at the bar, you know, what's the use of going out and doing things? Everything I need is right here. And then got to the point where I couldn't even really hang out with other people even at the bar anymore. And I would go and sit at the corner of the bar with a book. And I would give people the nasty look if they tried to talk to me. And I think part of me was telling myself that if I'm out drinking, not drinking by myself at home, then I don't have a problem. And but by the end, where I was sitting in my lazy boy smoking cigarettes, I would get off work. I would get into a bottle of bourbon, a case of PBR. I would start reading. I'm a big reader. I love it. You know, it's a way for me to escape. And I would read as long as I could before I got too drunk. And then I would flip on the TV and watch DVR'd episodes of Intervention and Oprah. Nobody will intervene on me. You know, and, you know, there were consequences all through that. I was 21 the first time I got evicted from an apartment. Over that 6-year span, I lived in 14 different places. I got evicted from another apartment a few years later. I had one roommate sue me, the nerve. Apparently, she was upset that I didn't pay, rent or bills. You know, and again, you know, like my delusion, for years, I had a huge resentment against this woman for doing that to me, you know. And she was a drinker, and she did drugs, and, you know, and I was like, that's the reason why we got evicted from that apartment. But it's so interesting how I get this clarity, and I look back, and I'm doing my inventory. And, you know, I didn't pay rent. I didn't pay bills. Any more than she did. And she ended up paying for it to keep us out of court. So, of course, she sued me for the other half. You know, it was a really cool experience actually making amends with her. I had a bunch of different jobs. I have the innate ability to sense when I'm about to be in trouble at work, and I quit. There's always some excuse, rationalization or justification that I can get for it. You know, I can make more money over here. That new manager is awful, etc. And I would jump to a different job. I'm the king of many geographics. You know, I'll move from this person's apartment to sleeping on this person's couch. I'll quit this job, go get this job. That's really what my life was like, you know, until the time I was around 26. By this point, I'm running a catering company. I got this really awesome job. When I look back at it, it was a really amazing job, and I really enjoyed what I did. Running this catering company, a large percentage of what this catering company did was weddings, so I had worked with a lot of people doing that. The company I worked for, our shop and our restaurant, was located in a building with apartments above it. The company paid for my apartment. It was this cool loft apartment with the spiral staircase that overlooked the farmer's market in downtown Richmond. I learned real quick that me and spiral staircases do not go well together. So there's like this whole bedroom upstairs that never had furniture or anything in it. I slept on a futon mattress in my living room because I could never, by the time I was ready to pass out, make it up that staircase. I'm a faller. I'm a bruiser. I can't begin to tell you how many times people ask me who I got in a fight with when I get to work the next morning, and I'm like, the sidewalk. So it was a really cool apartment. I had a company car and a company credit card, which came in real handy when my paycheck was spent 3 days after I got it. I never would have told you I was a thief, but the truth of the matter is that I embezzled from that company. You know, I'm running the company. I'm the one keeping the accounts. And I did that to maintain my drinking. And if I wasn't stealing money from the company, I was stealing alcohol. It was a catering company restaurant, so it was real easy for me to do that. On the surface, it looks like I have this really cool job. A lot of benefits come along with it. I'm making great money. And by this time in my life, I'm drinking in the morning when I wake up. First time I discovered the morning drink was another turning point in my life. That was a magical experience. I wake up in the morning and I drink. I make my way down to the office for a couple hours and I sneak up to my apartment and I drink. At this point, if I go too long without drinking, I get the shakes and the sweats. I'm 26 years old. But I had no clue. In the back of my head, something told me that I was probably drinking too much, but I really, the idea of being an alcoholic or that something major needed to change my life never crossed my mind. I would sit in my lazy boy getting drunk watching Intervention, and feeling sorry for myself, and I would have these dreams and these fantasies that one day something's just magically going to change and my life's going to become, white picket fence. So, subconsciously, I knew that there was something wrong, but, I couldn't have told you that at the time. But my boss told me one day. I was meeting with a couple planning their wedding menu on a Saturday morning, 9 o'clock in the morning. And after the meeting later that evening, my boss sat me down. And he told me that I was drunk during the meeting and that as a result of that, we lost a client. My first reaction to that was honestly like, no, I wasn't. That was honest for me at that moment. And so we talked about it, and I was just basically like, I drank the night before, I'm sure, blah, blah. And he was like, Jeremy, he was like, you reeked of alcohol, you were slurring, you couldn't even stand up straight. And I was like, I'm so sorry, it won't happen again. The next morning, it was a Sunday. Sundays are my favorite day of the week. It's my one day off working for a catering company. We work a lot of weekends. And I love being able to wake up and start drinking with not having to worry about being caught or anything like that. I'm, have at it. And so I would always set my alarm on Sunday mornings to get up and start drinking. I didn't do that during the week. And I would go to this little diner, and I would have a cup of coffee, a few Bloody Marys, and I'd grab a newspaper, and then I'd go next door to my little regular bar, and I'd switch to Greyhounds, and then I'd eventually end up with shots of Rumpelmintz and Budweiser. And this is my normal Sunday routine. Normally, 1, 2, 3 o'clock, you never really know. I'd crawl myself the block away back up to my apartment, and I'd take a nap, meaning I would pass out in the middle of my living room floor. And normally on Sundays, what would happen, I'd wake up, and I'd go back to the bar until 2 a.m. I mean, that was every Sunday for I don't even know how long. This particular Sunday, I woke up in the middle of my living room floor, and I had a moment of clarity. You know, and I realized that this wonderful job I have is in danger. This amazing apartment I have is absolutely trashed. I've got empty liquor, wine, 40 bottles all over the place. Fruit flies, to-go containers filled the fridge, and when the fridge couldn't fit anymore, I would just set them next to the fridge. Sink full of dirty dishes, it was absolutely disgusting. A good friend of mine, actually when I got sober this last time, went in and cleaned out my apartment for me. And he said that I was worthy of hoarders, and he took out 8 large black trash bags of empty liquor bottles, and a few different bins of them as well. I know people hide liquor bottles. I keep the empty ones. I couldn't begin to tell you why. Maybe it's because I didn't want people to know how much I was drinking, but I never really had that thought, you know. They were everywhere. They were like under the bathroom sink. This is crazy. So I have this moment of clarity. I realize my job's in danger. This amazing apartment I have is trashed. You know, the great money that I'm making working for this company is only gone within a few days after I get paid, and then I'm stealing. And so I come to the conclusion that my drinking's a problem. And I decide that if my drinking's a problem, I need to stop for a while. If drinking's my problem, I'll just stop. Problem solved. You know, I went to my boss and I told him, I was like, thank you for having the talk. I'm going to stop drinking. I'm going to, you know, get myself together. I'm going to get a gym membership. And I think he had a better understanding of how bad off I was than I did, because he asked me to go meet a friend of his for coffee, and went across the street to this diner that Monday. And it was a busy lunch. I mean, the place was super crowded, and I'm standing in there, and this guy comes in, and he walks over, and he walks right up to me, and he says, "You must be Jeremy." I'm like, "How do you know?" Sweating. So we sat down, had coffee, and this guy told me about how he had gotten sober in Alcoholics Anonymous and asked me if I wanted to go to a meeting with him. And I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that afternoon. Really, I think what was on my mind was appeasing my boss. I'll tell you, though, that I was really floored when I went to the meeting. I had no idea what to expect. Out of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I don't remember too much, but I know when I left there, the thought that I had in my head was, wow, what a great group of people. I'm really glad there's something like that for people that need it. And, you know, I'm sure they did the readings and how it works and talked about steps and, you know, what we do here. And I'm sure my thinking was probably like, you know, gosh, you guys must be really bad to need that. But I just have a drinking problem. I'm just going to stop. Problem solved. So I did go see a doctor because somebody told me that my withdrawal symptoms were really bad and that apparently alcohol withdrawal could be deadly, which really scared me. I had no clue. So I went to see a doctor, did a detox in his office, a rapid detox. He prescribed Anabuse for me. Which is a fun drug that if you drink while you're taking it, makes you violently ill. I have no experience with that. I didn't drink while I was taking it those 3 days. And those 3 days I was taking it. The next, I think I made it about 2 months. We were talking, Billy and I, before the meeting, we were talking about Clancy talking about this idea that our problem is being sober. It's not being drunk. And during that next 2 months, what I can tell you is that my life got miserable real quick. I hated my job. I hated my boss. I hate myself. I hate where I'm living. You know, that thing in the inside that Clancy talks about just got tighter and tighter and tighter. I had no clue that was alcoholism. I just thought my life sucked, which it kind of did. I love the idea that we talked about and more about alcoholism, this idea that there's no mental defense against the first drink. The idea that the thought is not going to come at all, or if it does come, it's not going to be strong enough to keep me from drinking. And two and a half months in, working a wedding, cake cutting comes around. That's caterer's favorite part of the wedding, because that's when we can start to clean up, and normally when we would start drinking. And normally what happens, you pass out 200 flutes of champagne for the toast, and then you walk around and you pick up 200 half-empty flutes of champagne. And, you know, we did that, and then a few minutes later I was standing behind the wedding tent smoking a cigarette and realized that I had tossed back a flute of champagne. Thought never came to me, you know. I didn't even realize it until a few minutes later. My first thought was, the world didn't explode. Maybe I made too big a deal out of this whole not drinking thing. So we get back to the shop after that. I grabbed a bottle of Jack Daniels and went up to my apartment, and within 2 weeks was drinking in the morning, drinking around the clock. At this point, my drinking progressed. You know, I'm drinking even more. I'm not getting as good of an effect from alcohol as I used to. And I'm trying to drink without anybody knowing. As far as my boss and the people I work with know, I'm sober. Looking back, I realized that was completely ridiculous, that I thought that they had no clue. I think it says in A Vision for You, it talks about the great obsession that every alcoholic can drink without people knowing, or something like that. You know, a few weeks of that went by, and my boss sat me down. He said, "Jeremy, you're drinking again." I'm like, "No, I'm not." He's like, "You're drinking again, and if you don't do something about it, I'm going to have to ask you to leave the company." So, you know, I gather up my my forces. I try to figure out what it is exactly I can do about this drinking problem that I have. I go back to see the doctor. He gives me a different kind of medication that's supposed to help with cravings. I joined an intensive outpatient program, which was very beneficial in a lot of ways. We started each session, we had got the sheet with all the different faces, and we had to identify what emotions we felt that day. So that was fun. Thank God my sobriety does not rely on how I'm feeling. I mean, good Lord. But I got to, you know, during those sessions, I got to talk about how much my life sucked, and it was great. What was really awesome about that IOP program that I was in was that I was required to go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was required to get a sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I started going to meetings. I got hooked in with some young people's meetings, met some cool people who were sober, and started going to a lot of meetings and got involved with the fellowship. And started to do the thing, same thing that I'd always relied on in my entire life, was to try to pretend like everybody else is, you know. And that was about as far as I was willing to go. You know, you hear it all the time. I know how y'all work AA here. So, you know, when I hear "don't drink and go to meetings," I cringe, because for about 9 months, I didn't drink, and I went to meetings, and I got crazier and crazier and crazier. I hated my job, I hated my life, I hated myself, I hated you. And Alcoholics Anonymous started getting really crappy. I started to hate the meetings, I started to hate the people in it. I started to become that guy who would share about being an atheist. You know, I was probably Jim Burwell on crack. you know, I resented my way right out of Alcoholics Anonymous during that time. You know, I may have had the unity side of the triangle down. I was going to meetings, I was hanging out with several people, but when you all talked about steps, when you all talked about having a psychic change or spiritual experience, I didn't think I needed that. You know, my drinking is my problem. My thinking, I'm a very intelligent person, thank you very much. I do not require psychic change. You know, so much of what we do, it's absolutely necessary through these steps, like that psychic change, a complete displacement of old ideas and motivations, you know, a profound alteration in the way we look at the world and react to the world, is absolutely necessary if I want to stay sober, and I didn't think I needed it. And on Cinco de Mayo 2010, I decided that after not going to AA for several weeks, I decided that I was going to go out and have a few beers with friends. Now, having been through this IRP, having been to Alcoholics Anonymous, being pretty aware that when I drink, bad things happen, I'm like, this is probably not going to turn out too well. But when things get bad again, I'll just head back to AA. That's the thought I had. So the thought came to me that me taking that first drink was probably not a great idea. It was not strong enough to keep me from doing it. I have no mental defense against the first drink. I went out and had two beers that night. It's probably the only time in my entire life I only had two drinks. And within the week, I was drinking 9 o'clock. The next 6 months of my life was a hell I never, ever want to go back to. At this point, the best I can hope to get out of alcohol is to pass out, to blot out the miserable existence of my life. I sit in my lazy boy night after night, smoking, raising a glass to my lips against my will. I do not want to be drinking. I do not want my life to be the way it is. But I have absolutely zero power over it. I would get off work and I would go up to my apartment and I'd be like, I'm not going to drink. I'm not going to drink. I'm not going to drink. And I would pace back and forth and back and forth. And then my legs would carry me down the street to get something to drink. I had to. And during that time, I thought about going back to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I couldn't bring myself to do it. I would get in the car with the intention to go to AA, and before I could pull out of the parking lot, I would have an anxiety attack, and I would have to go back and get something to drink. I had lost the power of choice. There was no doubt about that, because I desperately wanted to be sober at that point. I desperately knew that alcohol was killing me. And that's true. My body was failing. I don't eat when I drink like that. I've always been a skinny guy. I was probably about 25 pounds lighter then. I was throwing up a lot, throwing up blood. I would have to eat bottles of Tums just to be able to keep the alcohol down. And there was blood in the toilet, and I had abdominal pain. Clearly, I had some GI issues going on as a result of my drinking. And I would sit in my lazy boy, and I knew that there was something seriously wrong, and I knew that I was dying. I just knew it. And that bleak November, what really scared me was that I didn't know how much longer it was going to take for me to die. And so I climbed up the spiral staircase. I got an electrical cord, and I tied one end around my neck and the other around the banister. And I stood there for a very long time. I didn't want to die. I was terrified of dying. But I could not keep living the way I was. And clearly I didn't kill myself. I think I was just too scared to, you know. And the thought that I did have was, if I wake up the next morning, because I never knew if I would, you know, for weeks on end, I was wondering if the night I passed out was going to be the last one. And I said, if I wake up in the morning, I'm going to call for help. And I woke up the next morning and I called Richmond Intergroup office. And they were trying to get a hold of my sponsor that I had during my previous trip in sobriety. In the meantime, I just couldn't wait any longer. And I got in a cab and was on my way to the hospital. I knew I needed to do something. While I had it, and ended up, they called me, and I went to my sponsor's house. They took me to the hospital. I look back, and there are all these little moments of grace, evidence that there was something bigger going on. What I didn't tell you was like 2 weeks, but I think it was exactly 2 weeks before that, because it was around Halloween. I went to MCV in Richmond to try to get help. And the doctor was extremely irritated that I was in his emergency room. And he gave me a prescription from some sort of benzo to detox myself, like an alcoholic's good at that, right? So those lasted a day or two. But this time, the doctor I saw in the emergency room actually turned out to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Told me what I already knew, that if I'd continued drinking the way I was, I would have been dead within a few weeks. I knew that, And they put me in ICU for severe withdrawal. I had a lot of internal bleeding, GI bleeding from my drinking, and I was severely malnourished. And I spent 2 days in ICU, a few more days in the regular hospital before they would put me into the detox unit, Tucker's. And the doctor came in one day to tell me I was out of the woods and that I wasn't going to die. And my sponsor texted me. And what I can tell you is laying in that hospital bed 3 or 4 days in, when he told me that, it was like the darkness just descended. It was like blackness came in. And the idea that I was not going to die, I figured that would be the easy way if I just died in the hospital. I could not imagine leaving the hospital and going back to drinking the way I'd been living my life. There was no way that was going to happen. And I was absolutely incapable of believing that life was going to be worth living without drinking. And, I just couldn't imagine. I was incapable of imagining this. Truly hopeless. And my decision was that when I got out of the hospital, I was going to jump off a bridge. It was going to have to be something quick. And cue higher power. How dark it is before the dawn. That exact moment, my sponsor came to visit me in the hospital. And I don't remember a lot of the talk, but I remember being very angry, very upset at the very idea that a God could put me in the situation I had been in. Look at my life. How is it possible that there's a loving God that you're trying to talk about? And I was just like, I can't believe in that. And probably one of the most profound things I've ever heard, and thank God for it, is when they said, that's okay. Do you believe that I believe that if you take these actions like I did, you can get sober and have a life worth living? That was the question that was put to me. Maybe. I had just a little bit of a maybe there. I could go for that. That's good enough. I spent a few more days in the detox unit. I'm appalled when I look back at how I acted there. I screamed at the nurses. I was like so angry. It's just like so like not me at all. I was yelling at the nurses to give me phenobarbital and just being super angry. So my sponsor came to pick me up on a Friday after being in the hospital that whole week. And they took me directly down to Virginia Beach for the Pockets of Enthusiasm conference. And it was the last conference there. And that is when I made my sobriety date. It's the next day after I got a detox, November 13th, 2010. I figured it probably wasn't fair for me to say I was sober when I'm screaming at nurses to give me drugs. So I got to this conference, and the kind of people who go to conferences, right? They were so excited I was there. I guess everybody found out that I was right out of detox. I met Billy there. I had spent that weekend crying and laughing, and like I would go from one extreme to the other. Well, I mean, that weekend, probably the next few weeks. That Friday night of the conference, I couldn't sleep. I couldn't sleep for months into sobriety. So that was at Virginia Beach, and the hotel was right on the ocean front. And I walked down to the beach at like 6 o'clock in the morning, because I'd just been laying in bed there for a while doing nothing inside my head. It's great company. And I walked down the beach and I watched the sun come up. And what I now know, when I look back on it, you know, I said a prayer. I didn't know it was a prayer. And in a way, it was like my second and third step kind of rolled into one. You know, I watched the sun come up, and what I said was, what do I have to lose? You know, what do I have to lose? Maybe these people can help me. Maybe this beautiful sunrise can mean more to me than, you know, it's ever meant before. And I decided I was going to go all in. What do I have to lose? I'm going to do everything these people tell me to do. Worst case scenario, it doesn't work, and I've got a backup plan for that. And that's what I did, you know. I mean, that is about the best I could manage in early sobriety, let me tell you. Because I was an emotional wreck. I had panic attacks. I was depressed. I couldn't seem to get out of bed. I was angry. You know, I went from living by myself for a while. They suggested I move into a men's recovery house. I did that. I was living with a bunch of dudes, and I hated it. And, you know, early sobriety was rough. You know, why wouldn't it be, right? You know, like, Thanksgiving came around, and I went to an alcohol we have every year in Richmond, and everybody was sharing about gratitude, right? I'm like 2 weeks sober, like, you know. I remember calling my sponsor that night and just going off and venting. Man, I was a whiner. I really was. I was talking about how awful my life was and how everything sucked. And the response I got was, that's okay. You're allowed to feel the way you feel. How do you expect to feel 2 weeks sober? I was like, oh, okay. This is what you need to do. Go upstairs, pull out your big book, read page 86 through 88, say the prayers, and then I want you to call somebody else. And I did it. And that was like the first like 6 months I was sober, was doing stuff like that. I met with my sponsor 2-3 times a week. We went through the big book. They shared their experience with how they relate in the big book. They helped me find my own experience in the big book. When it said to do something, we did it. When it said to pray something, we prayed. And I don't believe in prayer. I don't believe in God. I don't believe in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I had the willingness to do whatever I was told to do. And I kept doing it. And thank God for you members of Alcoholics Anonymous practicing our primary purpose. If it wasn't for that, I'd be dead. You know, I could not have gotten through those early weeks without people surrounding me, immersing me in this deal, not allowing me to rely on how I was feeling. I was told I needed to be willing to be uncomfortable just to keep taking the actions. At my 6 month anniversary, by that point, I'd been through the steps. I'd gotten cleared ahead of time to go and carry a message into the Tucker's detox unit. You have to be 6 months sober to do so. My sponsor took me in there on my 6 month anniversary. And unbeknownst to me, you know, this whole time I'm miserable in sobriety. And I was sitting there sharing my story across from the people where I'd been 6 months before that. And I had a spiritual experience. And it just came crashing on to me how much I had changed, how much my life had changed, and how actually I wasn't so miserable as I thought I was. And from then on, it just sort of started to get better and better. I started sponsoring people by the time I was 7-8 months sober. I carried meetings into Tucker's. I carried meetings into prison. I was involved in a home group and had a service position in that home group from the get-go, because that's what I was told to do, and I did it. And my sobriety since then has been exactly that. You They say you don't have to go back to basics if you keep doing it. Keep packing. I've been taught to do the take the action in all three sides of the circle and the triangle, and I'll be safe and protected from alcohol. And that's been my experience. My grand sponsor always says the best we get here is human. I'm still prey to the human condition. It says in Bill's story, life's certain trials and low spots ahead. That's life. You know? And I can tell you that for somebody who is bristled with antagonism and was absolutely against the idea of a very God, of spirituality, I was told that if I take these actions, which turned out they were spiritual in nature, I had no clue, that would take care of itself, and it did. You know, everybody's journey, spiritual journey is different, and mine continues to grow and evolve and change, but I'll tell you, that's a miracle that I believe that there's something bigger out there. And thank God for these actions. You know, I was told early on, it doesn't matter what I think, feel, or believe, it's what I do. It's the actions we take here that matter. Because I've been through periods in sobriety where that anxiety, that depression comes back on, where my agnosticism comes back on. You know, my sponsor says the shine wears off. You know, I went through those terrible twos. It's like the first year, as much as it sucked, I look back and it's kind of nice, you know, because there's so much change. Like, I just so drastically went from a hopeless mess to doing much better. And then you hit 2 years, and damn gifts of sobriety, you know, I've got a job and I've got bills and life hits me. And I just feel like there needs to be more, right? Maybe, you know, is this as good as it gets? Maybe there's not really a God, you know, because by this point I believe there is. I have perfect proof that there is, because I wouldn't be sober otherwise. Keep taking the actions, I was told. Find more sponsees, get more involved in service. And there I find a deeper relationship with a higher power. And in my experience, through all of the mistakes and screw-ups I've had in sobriety, through all the dark times I've had, I come out the other side with a deeper understanding of myself, a deeper understanding of alcoholism and sobriety, and a deeper relationship with my power greater than myself. And, you know, I've been told that we grow and change the most through those dark periods, those dark nights of the soul. And we're allowed to make mistakes. Thank goodness, you know. And a few more minutes. It has been drilled into me since the get-go that the problem is always the same, and it's me and my mind. Selfishness and self-centeredness, that's the root of our problem. Going through that early sobriety was tough. You know, it says in Bill's story, simple but not easy. A price has to be paid. And I look back and all my attempts at sobriety, my ideas, you know, my thoughts that I know better than you people, my thoughts that I know better than I agree with myself, I wasn't willing to pay the price. You know, you all, we have to do the work here. We have to continue putting one foot in front of the other, chopping wood and carrying water. And that is not easy all the time. But that's the price we pay. And, you know, it means destruction of self. So I've learned a lot that, you know, what the problem is. And through the process of inventory and amends, I look back at my, let me tell you about my stepfather, who was abusive to me. He was a monster in my mind. An absolute monster from the depths of hell. A man pure evil. And I would tell anybody about him. You know. And I blamed my entire life on that. I got a lot of clarity of that in my fourth step and even in my fifth step. During my fifth step, when I was talking about this, I was in the middle of a sentence and I stopped. Because this memory popped into my head out of nowhere. And it was of me being probably like 5, 6 years old and being sick and curled up in the lap of this awful man who was just holding me because I didn't feel well. And it was just like all of a sudden my brain opened up. It was like something unlocked. And I remembered, I looked back, this man was doing the best he could. And he really did try to love us. You know, perhaps he's just spiritually sick. You know, he was left with two kids after his alcoholic drug addict wife left him. He was just doing the best he could. And I was able to look back and, you know, see that there really were moments of love in that household. And that was a profound experience. And stuff like that has continued to happen for me as a result of the actions we take here. So the problem is always me, my mind, the way I see things. And I've been told the solution is always the same. It's to turn outwards. It's to be of service to other people. It's the most important thing we do when all other measures fail. And for somebody who got here not believing in God, that's really important for me to know, even in sobriety. I am of the school of thought that these actions, these steps, these things, these turning outwards and being service to other people is what leads me to a higher power. When I'm sitting down one-on-one with another alcoholic is when I'm the most spiritual. I've had most of my spiritual experiences have happened like that. If it was the other way around, if I had to find God before this deal would work for me, before I was capable of helping other people, I wouldn't be here. But I've been drilled and trained and told that everything we do here is about helping other people. And if I continue to do that, I will be safe and protected from drinking. And I will have a relationship with a power greater than myself that will keep me sober. In sobriety, I've worked in bars, bartending. You know, that the obsession to drink, the problem of drinking has been removed. You know, that fleeting thought that may come here and there, it's very rare for me these days, goes away very quickly. You know, I started going back to school. I recently just bought a car, which is really exciting. I got in a wreck a week later, and the passenger door doesn't open, so now it's a true alcoholic car. you know, I'm fully self-supporting. It's amazing. I pay all my bills, and you know, this is all material stuff, which is great. The biggest gift that I've gotten from Alcoholics Anonymous by continuing to take these actions is that I have a life worth living. I do not wake up in the morning in a full-blown panic attack anymore, wondering how I'm going to get by in reality. I most of the time have a sense of peace and serenity about me. I have a purpose. You know, I know why I'm here. I'm on borrowed time. Everything I'm here for, I know now. You know, my whole entire life I was looking for what's the deal here, you know, and now I know. If I knew it would get me the same results, I would go back and do it all over again. Thank you for my life.